Welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, January 7th, 2019. This is the Top of the Pile. Of course, the episode of the week in which I talk about some of my favorite books from last week. And I haven't done one of these in a while, and I've got five books I'm going to talk about. Before I do that, I want to just give a brief announcement. If you check the show notes, you'll find a schedule for this show going forward. I'm bringing in some help. Starting tomorrow, I'm bringing in Dustin, who runs a YouTube channel, Generally Learning. Go check that out. He's going to be doing the Comic Talk headlines on Tuesdays and Fridays, which means that's going to free me up to do a few other things. So check out the schedule. We're going to bring in some new stuff. Wednesday, I'm doing the rant. Thursday will be a throwback Thursday, in which I'll do Invisibles Episode 1. Next week, we're going to premiere a new collector segment. I think that'll be pretty exciting. And we've got some things cooking up down the line, including a monthly roundtable episode in which we'll discuss some hot topics for the month. That's being run by Joey Galvez from the Batpod, so stay tuned for that as well. Again, check the show notes. You get a link to the calendar so you can see what's coming up. All right, full week, full month. There's like 22 episodes this month. It's going to be crazy. I'm a crazy man. Let's talk about some comics, though. This week, we're going to be talking about five books, one Aftershock, two DC, two Marvel. Let's kick off with Aftershock. And I'm glad that I get to talk about this book on this podcast because normally I save all my Aftershock discussions for the Aftershock Central podcast. But because only one book came out last week, we decided not to record. And that's good for me because I can talk about it on this episode of Comic Talk Today. And that book is Animosity number 18, written by Marguerite Bennett, layouts by Raphael De La Torre, finishes by Eltan Tomasi, colors by Rob Schwaggy P. Schwager. Inside joke, by the way. Go listen to that podcast. It's great. Aftershock Ninja Podcast. And letters by Marshall Dillon. And I love this book. I haven't talked about it too much on this podcast, except briefly when I mentioned like one of those things that you should be reading from Aftershock. And I gotta tell you, this book is 18 issues in. And it is very difficult to recommend a book when it's 18 issues in. We all know as comic fans, we want the first issue, maybe we want miniseries, things like that. And it's really great that Aftershock has been able to foster a set of creators that can tell the story and tell it the way that they want to tell it. And sure, this book is 18 issues in, but let me tell you, Animosity is one of those comics that really levels up the game in terms of what a comic can be. And if you've never read it, the basic premise is that there's an event, the Awakening, where animals kind of become conscious, they can talk, they have feelings, emotions, and of course that causes a ton of problems because they're fighting back and forth with humans in terms of resources. Resources are very limited. Obviously you can't, once an animal is conscious, can you really kill them? So this book really dives into some really deep ethical stuff. And if you just read your comics because you want some fun superhero stuff, and that's cool, this book is not going to be for you. But if you want to see just what comics can do, I highly, highly recommend you check out Animosity. There is a companion book, Animosity Evolution, that takes place on the West Coast. So it's kind of like Walking Dead-ish in a way, right? Because of that, you have Animosity proper on the East Coast, and then you have Animosity Evolution on the West Coast. And that book's really great as well, so I recommend checking that out. I think that's on issue 9 or 10, so it might be a little more approachable. But this one's really good. Over the course of this book, we've had Jessie, who's a young girl, that's being followed by, well, number one, Sandor, her dog, her family dog, before this event. He's been kind of serving as her father figure because her parents were killed, partially because of a riot, partially because of her dog. Anyway, long story, but really good story. And, they're working their way from, the East Coast. I think they're going through Georgia. On the way to the West Coast to find her brother, who was the last person in her family. And her brother is a big part of the Animosity Evolution book. He's a vet. And so, of course, he's very important to the animals. But anyway, she's trying to get across to meet up with her brother and has these animals in tow. And over the last couple of issues, we've met this new antagonist, I guess, the members of the Walled City. And it is a city of humans who don't believe that animals should have any rights, that they should be subservient to humans and do their bidding. And of course, because of this whole event, the main drive for the people of the Walled City is to procreate as quickly as possible and give them a fighting chance against the animals. Because of course, because there's many different species of animals, there are a ton of animals anywhere. And of course, a lot more animals than there are people. And so in order to kind of become the ruling species once again, they want to populate as quickly as possible. And as a result, we have some very nice things going on. They basically have a breeding program where women are constantly pregnant and giving birth, regardless of their age. As long as they're still able to get pregnant, they are kept pregnant, and it's been really interesting to see that story. Of course, this deals a lot with female rights and things like that, but it's really, really good, very deep. Jesse kind of finds out this whole thing is going on in the last issue. In this issue, we pick up from the events of the last one as she begins to free some of these women that are basically being used as cattle to continuously breed. And there's some really good interactions here. The book is structured very interestingly because we do have a narrative in this issue, but the first few pages are basically silent, and you actually just follow the lyrics of the song Mary Don't Weep, made a little more popular by Aretha Franklin. But I believe it's an old slave song, if I'm not mistaken, from before the Civil War. So really interesting to see the lyrics in this song and how they play directly into the events of the book. Really well done, and I think that's something that Marguerite Bennett does really, really well. The headmistress, of course, is kind of the ruler of this walled city, and Jesse confronts her. Jesse's kind of become, I hate to cuss in this podcast, but kind of a badass. You know, she started off being just this young girl, 9 or 10 years old, very sheltered life that she lived. And even though, you know, her parents had their issues, and you can read the book to learn more about that. But over the course of the series, she's really become much, much stronger and had to learn very quickly to survive. And, you know, Travis and Ronnie and I talk about this quite a bit when we talk about this book, because this is a very different world, and you often wonder if you were placed in a situation like this, that it literally is, how will you survive till the next day? Then, of course, you're going to be doing some pretty crazy things in order to do so. And that's one of the things that we've talked about with these people in the walled city, where we definitely don't agree with their ethics and their politics, but if your species was kind of on the brink of extinction, then what is it that you would do to make sure that doesn't happen? And that's kind of what the walled city people are doing. Obviously, Jesse doesn't really agree with that. She frees the breeders, as they call them, and there's a whole pretty interesting interaction between her and the headmistress, who kidnapped Sandor. The animals led by Sandor attacked the walled city. And it's really interesting, the interaction between those two. Sandor kind of tells Jesse, just go ahead and kill her. Don't even worry about me. He is dying. So, of course, maybe he doesn't feel like his life is worth her not taking the chance. But she doesn't have to kill him. And I think that's really interesting and important in terms of the story, because the fact that she does not kill the headmistress really says a lot about who Jesse has become. Although it doesn't mean that she's become a better person necessarily, because she actually decides not to kill the headmistress in order for the breeders to get their chance at this woman. And I thought that was really, really well done. Once the headmistress is dead, the battle kind of comes to a halt, and humans that are living in the walled city need to decide, will they continue fighting for their beliefs as they've been doing the entire time, or will they try to be more civil and try to live with the animals and join the breeders in kind of a new commune out in the woods? And some of the soldiers decide to follow them, some don't, and those that don't decide to follow them end up being killed by wild boars, who are, I mean, definitely extremely dangerous animals. I don't know if you've ever seen a wild boar. They are hideous and they're extremely mean, and now that they're conscious, I'm sure they're even worse. So really interesting stuff. I like the whole biblical imagery in here as well. There's a lot of references to Noah's Ark, of course, that's referenced in Mary Don't Weep, and so that's why that song is important here. But it does talk about how through Noah's flood, you know, humanity was killed by water, and now after Noah landed on solid ground, God promised he would no longer do this kind of thing to humanity, that the next time it would be a death by fire. And of course, the book ends with a death by fire as the whole walled city is burned down. I love this book. If you couldn't tell, I love this book. And if you ever get a chance to hear us discuss this book on Aftershock Central, by all means, go do that. Ronnie and Travis are extremely smart guys, and I love chatting with them about comics. So, Animosity number 18, brilliant, brilliant stuff. Loved it. Even with the artist change, I believe Rafael De La Torre quit being the main artist in the last issue. He's doing the layouts for the book, but Elton Tomasi's art is pretty similar to Rafael De La Torre, so it's not a huge change, and it's absolutely beautiful to look at. So, Animosity number 18, 5 out of 5. I'm pretty sure I've given all 18 issues of this book a 5 out of 5. And I know some of you guys really appreciate my recommendations. And, you know, I like to think that I'm not going to lead anyone astray. So if I really, really recommend a book strong enough, then a lot of people go and check those out. And I hope you will check this one out as well, because it is fantastic. I don't know how long it's going to last, but boy, do I love the ride going all the way in. So, 5 out of 5, Animosity number 18. I want to talk about Champions number 1 real quick. Written by Jim Zub, art by Steve Cummings, colors by Marcia Meniz and Eric Arciniega, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And the reason I would talk about it is because I think this is a very interesting book. I wanted to look at some other reviews, and I just didn't get a chance to, and I really don't care, but, you know, I wanted to see what people thought about it so I can bring it into the discussion. But Champions is very interesting. This is the second iteration of a very similar team. So, you know, we have characters like Ms. Marvel in here, Sam Alexander, who was previously Nova. He's lost his powers at the end of the previous Champions run. Viv Vision is in here, the Vision's daughter. Ironheart, Braun, who is Amadeus Cho. He goes by Braun now. And I don't like that name. I don't know. Whatever. Ironheart is in here, which I've really been digging her book, so it's nice to see her in here. Snowguard, which is a new character that premiered pretty late in the run of Champions. Interesting character. She is an Inuit with pretty cool abilities. Snowguard, Locust, Power Man, Wasp, and a bunch of other ones. I really like this book, and that's why I wanted to talk about it. And the thing is, I was not expecting to like this at all, because Marvel's been kind of on a streak as of, we'll say 6 months to a year, of really trying to carve a niche for their younger characters. You know, it's probably longer than a year, because Champions ran for, 30 issues or something. But, you know, they've been trying to do something different, and I think that's really important, right? So we as old fogey comic book readers, and some of you younger listeners may not get this, but we often tend to like the things we like and don't want to change those things in many respects. And, you know, we see this all the time with characters like Batman, Captain America, and this, that, and the other. Like, you know, you can have Dick Grayson become Batman, but, you know, Bruce Wayne is Batman, although Dick is a better Batman. A lot of times. Not always, but a lot of times. But same with Cap. You know, you had Bucky take over. You had Falcon take over. So they try these kind of things all the time. And a lot of these characters are basically younger sidekick versions of the main characters. And I think with this iteration of Champions, I almost feel like Marvel is really beginning to embrace kind of the that sidekick thing, where they're not looking for a replacement, but they want these characters to come on their own. So in many respects, this book feels a lot like a Teen Titans, maybe. Kind of a little lighter, more comedic, definitely leaning towards a younger demographic. And that's weird, because I really like this book. And as an old man saying, I mean, old, I'm in my late 30s. But as an old man reading a book about teenage characters who are having teenage issues, it can sometimes be a little difficult to get through that stuff, right? And I've had this happen with a few other books, particularly over at Marvel, where they just kind of don't really jive with me for whatever reason. And for some reason, this one did. And part of that might be Jim Zub. I really like the way Jim Zub writes. The art is good as well. Steve Cummings, he definitely has that lighter, cartoonish type of art style, but for some reason it works. And the weird thing is, there are so many characters in this book. I mean, I mentioned, I don't know, half a dozen to a dozen in here, but there's a lot more in this particular book. Ms. Marvel has decided to split up the Champions into three different teams, and the reason she wants to do that is for them to be more efficient in solving issues around the world. So there are three teams operating at all times. I don't know if they've specified whether the teams themselves will have rotating rosters or whether they're all in the same roster. But they actually kind of make fun of that at one point. And I thought about this immediately. So that just kind of goes to show you how good a writer Jim Zub is and how much he understands what it is that he's doing. But at one point, one of the teams it's trying to break into a building. I can't remember what it is that they're doing, but they break into a building, and two of the flying characters, I can't remember what the other one was, Snowguard, and it might have been the Wasp, I can't remember. But there's two characters that go in there first because they can fly. And one of them makes a joke about, like, why would Ms. Marvel put two flying wing people on this team? And that's exactly what I thought. When I saw them come in, I was like, why are there two people with wings on? This doesn't make sense. And so I like how the book knows the kind of things that it's doing, and it does them really, really well. You know, some of the tropes that attach to a break, I think, are really well worth checking out. They may be subtle at times, so if you're not hugely versed in a whole lot of comics, maybe you're not going to understand some of those things. But I really dug this kind of stuff. The interaction between the characters is very well done. And of course, these characters are very young, so they have certain issues that some baggage, I guess you could say, that they come into these teams with. And that's pretty typical of a superhero team. But you also have certain issues just based on their age, right? So there's a whole thing in here, a subplot with Miles Morales. He's the Spider-Man in this book, where he's not really happy with the way the team is going. And he and Ms. Marvel have a pretty cool interaction. She feels like the reason for that is because he's not the team leader, and he feels he should be. I don't know if I agree with that, but maybe that's possible. Maybe that's the angle they're going with. I think of all of these, the most recognizable character might be Ms. Marvel still. Maybe not in overall media, but definitely for comics. Although, you know, Miles has a huge following, and I've kind of come around to Miles after watching Into the Spider-Verse. So, we'll see how that goes. But I really like the interaction. Him and, Amadeus Cho share a room, and, not him, Sam Alexander, the previous Nova. They share a room, and he won't let Sam in the room, and Amadeus is like, dude, just leave him alone, go away. Just don't be a prick. You know, he needs a space. And that works really well. You know, we used to get a lot more of that kind of stuff in the 80s and into the early 90s, where, the team dynamic was a little more soap opery. And I like that. It works so well in comics, especially when you have such a large, diverse cast of characters, as you do here. Again, I mean, there's three teams, so there's probably 20 different characters and champions. And part of that concerns me because, you know, it's very hard to write a team book, right? There's a lot of different personalities that you have to respect, right? Because most of these characters will have their own books. Maybe not so much here with the champions, but if you did like a Justice League, for example, all those characters have their own books. But it works so well, and I hope that Jim Zub can keep that, because I really like this. It's funny. It's full of action. It's full of great interaction. And I love how Ms. Marvel is trying to learn to be a team leader, even though she kind of put herself in that place. But she's still learning how to do that, right? And there's things where she'll mess up, like she doesn't really know how to inspire the troops. They're just kind of inspired because she's Ms. Marvel. And maybe for some of them, that's enough. There is some other weird stuff going on with Miles, though, and I don't want to kind of spoil it, but there is a villain that shows up at the end whom I love. This was my favorite villain, I don't know, 20 years ago, probably. I love this character. And I'm really happy to see him in this book, so I'm looking forward to the next one to see how that resolves. But I think if you haven't picked up Champions, it is I'm gonna recommend it. I'm not gonna give it a hard sale like I did with Animosity, but I'm definitely recommending it. And if you have kids roughly around the age of my kids, maybe I have a 15 and 8-year-old, then they might enjoy this book as well quite a bit. So maybe try to read this one with your kids. You might enjoy it. And you might learn something too. So, Champions number one. I'm gonna give this one, that's tough. That's tough. I'm gonna give it a 4 out of 5. I'm just gonna go for it. I was thinking about doing a half rating, but I've decided one of my resolutions is no more half ratings. I'm just gonna go full ratings. So, 4 out of 5 for Champions number one for Marvel Comics. From there, let's go on over to a DC book, and that is Detective Comics 995. Boy, am I happy to talk about a Detective Comics book on this podcast, because I haven't done so in forever. Partially on purpose. I try not to talk about Batman and Detective on the show when I do the Top of the Pile, because, I mean, back in the day at least, a lot of times I would just say 5 out of 5 every time, and that gets boring, you know what I mean? But I want to take a break from talking about those books, especially now that I've kind of come around to Tom King's Batman run, which I think is quite excellent as of late. I wanted to bring this in because, of course, we have a new creative team on Detective Comics as we go on the road to Detective Comics 1000, which is going to be very expensive for me. I don't think they've announced all the variant covers, and I think they've announced some of them, or at least who's doing them. But, you know, Detective Comics 1000 is a big, big deal, right? I mean, the book's been around since, I mean, it depends how you want to look at it. I think 37 is when Detective came out, but of course Batman didn't show up until Detective Comics number 27, and obviously it's his book now. He's been a huge part of it for a very long time. And, you know, that issue 1000 is going to be very expensive, man, because I've got to have like a bunch of blank variant covers to give to artists, and I still haven't even begun to decide which artists I will approach to do this. And I'm sure there's plenty of people ahead of me on this one where they've been planning on this for months. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I'm just the only weirdo doing that. But I do plan on buying probably every single variant that comes out for this book. I'm already regretting this decision. It's going to be so many. I mean, they're probably going to do like 30 covers or these, right? And that's not including like retailer variants. It's going to be so expensive. But whatever, it's fine. I love Batman. I'll do whatever I have to. All right, let's talk about this book. So Detective Comics 995, written by Peter Tomasi, whom, of course, I love in his previous Superman stuff. He's done the Super Sons. Art by Doug Mankey, an artist whom I love. I've loved for a long time. Inks by Jamie Mendoza. Colors by the one and only David Barron. He is a color genius. And letters by Rob Lee. And, man, this was interesting. So there is a death in this book, and I don't want to talk about the death, even though I guess by now people have read this, right? I mean, I would assume so, unless you have a DCBS box you're waiting on. Maybe you have not read it. But there is a death of a major character in this book, which I kind of didn't expect. I'm really good about not catching spoilers. And for some reason, like, I didn't set any... I mean, how would I know to set up a filter for this particular character? You know what I mean? But I missed all the spoilers for this. I read the book and I was like, huh, did that really just happen? Because this is a character that's been in the Batman family for a very long time, a character that's been really central to both Batman and Bruce Wayne as a whole. And now this person's gone. And it was very touching. I really liked the way that Tomasi handled this, and I liked the way that Mankey laid out the page when you kind of got to the moment of death, because you had kind of an interspersing of panels between past and present, and it works so well, because this character's known Bruce for a very long time, since he was a kid, and very important character. I was very surprised that this person is gone. I still don't know what to think about it, and I mean, I read this 4 or 5 days ago now, but really, really touching, and it just goes to show how good a writer Tomasi is. I mean, I'm so happy they put him on Detective. When Bendis took over the Superman books, I know that maybe he wasn't the happiest about the decision. I don't know how much he said publicly. I think I saw a couple things here and there. But I'm really glad they put him on such a big book, right? Because he did such a great job with that set of the characters. And now to see him in Detective, it's just really, really terrific. I can't wait to see what the build-up is to issue 1000. And I hope he stays on the book way beyond that. I mean, I think he might be the right guy for this book right now. There's references to stuff that happened before. So, for example, there's a reference to the Court of Owls, because at one point, while Bruce is trying to revive this character, doorbell rings, and Alfred goes to get the door, and the computer says it's Jim Gordon, Commissioner Gordon. So he opens the door, and he's like, "Hey, Jim," and he gets stabbed by a rapier in the chest. And actually punctures his lung. And obviously not Jim Gordon. And when Bruce comes up, he rings the bell. He has a little bell. He rings the bell. And Bruce comes up and, you know, he's sitting there bleeding. He's got a punctured lung. And, you know, Bruce is like, "All right, I'm going to do surgery on you and get you patched up. And then I'm going to go figure out what the hell's going on here." And Alfred's like, "No, don't do that." He's like, "Call Damien. Damien will come into the surgery." And Bruce is like, "Damien can't do surgery. He's like 5 years old." And he's like, "No, he did your surgery when you were passed out, so he can do mine as well. Just call Damien." So he calls Damien. Damien doesn't show up, at least not that we see. But he leaves Alfred at the mansion and goes to Arkham to try to get some information. And what's cool is that this Batman feels a little bit like the Batman that we're seeing over in Tom King's run, but angrier in some ways. You know, Bruce is very angry in that book because of Bane's machinations. And so, of course, he'd be very familiar with going to Arkham and dealing with people. But now you have this whole thing with Alfred and this other character that, you know, two of the most important people, I would say, in Bruce's life, aside from Selina, of course, but two of the most important. And, you know, one is now gone. The other one is maybe dead, and he is not having it. So whether there's going to be a tie into the Batman arc where Bane's kind of behind this whole thing, I maybe wouldn't be surprised. But I might be too. I don't know. But I really love this book. It's gorgeous. The art's fantastic. The coloring is incredible. I mean, David Baron, yikes. That guy's awesome. And it's a sight to behold. And again, the story is fantastic as well. So I know some people might be a little upset by this angry at Batman, but listen, Batman gets angry. You know what I mean? He might not be the spirit of vengeance, but when you piss him off, there's no stopping him. He is motivated, and we're definitely going to see that here. I love the final page. He goes into Arkham, and he talks to Dr. Arkham, and Arkham's just kind of loony, and he's like, I need to go see the inmates. And he kind of forces his way in. He's walking through the hallway, and you see a bunch of cast of characters that we know, right, some of the rogue galleries. And he's just kind of standing in the middle of the hallway, and he's like, you haven't seen a monster until now. The only monster in this room is me. And the lights go out, and you have Batman in kind of silhouette. Freaking awesome. I love that last page. Really, really good. I like the one of the final words of this character that passed away, who's talking to Bruce, and this person says, "The war you're waging to keep Gotham alive is also a war you wage against yourself." And I think that's, man, that really strikes at the core of what Batman is, right? And has always been. Because part of the reason he's a crime fighter is to, I mean, yes, avenge his parents, but, you know, make sure that this doesn't happen in Gotham anymore. And sometimes trying to fight those battles can really put people at odds with their core beliefs. And I think that's kind of what this person was trying to say. And it's definitely something that we're seeing in the Batman proper book, and kind of hinted at with the way this particular issue ends. So I loved it. Detective Comics 995. Guess what? It's a 5 out of 5. All right, back to Marvel. Let's talk about Conan the Barbarian number 1. I know some people are gasping because I was not at all excited for this book. I've never been a huge fan of Conan. I think part of that has nothing to do with the comics, by the way. I have read some of the comics. They're fantastic. I really like the run that Kerry Nord was in. I can't remember who wrote that. Is it Warren? No, Warren Ellis didn't write that. Anyways, somebody will correct me. But I love that run. And outside of that, I haven't really followed Conan. I read some of the Red Sonja stuff every once in a while. I like that book as well. But it's not one of those things where I'm like, I have to pick this up. And when this was announced, I was like, okay, Conan, that's cool. I like, maybe I'll pick up the first issue to see what it's like. But I didn't expect myself really wanting to push forward. And I forgot all about it until this past week when it's just magically in my Comixology inbox. And written by Jason Aaron, by the way, who, I mean, I should have known I was going to like this book. Spoiler alert, I like this book. I really like this book. Because I love what Jason Aaron has done over at Thor, and we'll get back to that in a second. Jason Aaron's writing, art by Mahmoud Esrar, colors by Matthew Wilson, and letters by Travis Lenham. Now, I will say this, the story for this issue is very simple. Very simple. And I think that's something that Jason Aaron does very well, where he can take a very simple story, a simple premise, and somehow make you really engrossed in the storyline. And this book is balls to the walls awesome. I know, many people are gasping right now, because I did not give two craps about this book. But I love this book. I am definitely continuing with this book. It is coming at a time for me where I don't feel like there's enough of this. You know, it's kind of sword and sorcery a little bit, but it's a little bit more than that. And there's something about the way that Jason Aaron writes that I just love, and I can't put my finger on it, and that bugs me sometimes. But I've been following his Thor run for a long time, and I haven't talked about Thor on this podcast in quite a while, but I really love that book. Every iteration of it. I mean, I think right now it's like the fourth book that he's done with Thor. He just does such an amazing job, and he really gets the character. And one thing that I noticed with Conan, starting to read it, I was like, well, yeah, of course they would pick Jason Aaron. This feels like Thor. Obviously, you don't have, you know, all-powerful gods fighting, whatever. But, I mean, Conan is almost that, right? And the Conan that we see here, we see two different Conans. We see a Conan in the past, where he is the Barbarian, and we see a Conan of the future, where he is King Conan. And the two stories end up colliding at the end of the issue. And that's something that Jason Aaron does very well as well. And so old Conan is kind of, you know, he's fighting in the, like, gladiator rings for money and in the City of Thieves. All he cares about is fighting all the time and making money. You know, when every time he wins a fight, he always gets paid the same. They talk about it in the book. You know, he's like half gold and half in wine, right? Because all he wants to do is go fight, get out, get drunk, pass out, maybe hang out with a couple ladies. You do see that quite a bit here, where he hangs out with a lot of ladies at the same time. And whatever. Like, he's just out to have a good time and fight and whatever. Go on to the next day. Well, along the way, he meets this woman who kind of wants to learn a little bit more about him, right? And at first, it seems pretty innocuous, right? It seems like this woman is kind of enthralled by Conan because he beats the crap out of this gigantic dude. And she kind of wants to get to know him. And she's kind of a sketchy character herself, right? She places all her money on Conan and ends up winning, of course, and the thieves don't want to pay her. So they're getting ready to sexually assault her, and she basically cuts both of them up and goes to talk to Conan and kind of makes fun of him. She makes fun of him. He makes fun of her. And of course that leads into sexy time. And so in the middle of sexy time, it turns out that she's a witch. She is called the Crimson Witch, and she has been traveling the lands looking for really powerful men, heroes, whose blood will be able to fulfill this sacrifice where she can bring back her god that she worships from the Netherrealm. And so Conan's tied up, and there's a whole battle between them. He escapes and has to fight some of the previous people that she has killed in order to try to bring about this god from coming in. And the whole time you're going back and forth between that and him as King Conan, where he's much wiser, much more reserved, much more thoughtful about his actions. Whereas in the past, in the main story, he is very rash in his decisions. And ultimately those two stories collide because after a battle, Conan's looking around and he sees these two kids kind of robbing the corpses on the battlefield. And they say some, like, deep words that no kid would ever say. But that's because these are not normal kids. They end up being, spoiler alert, the Crimson Witch's kids. And, I mean, I'm kind of assuming maybe Conan's kids as well. That's not implied. I haven't seen anything about this book saying that they are, but to me that's what it felt like. Because the amount of time that passes between the present or past storyline, the main storyline, and the King Conan stuff seems to be roughly about the time that these kids ages, which, I don't know, I would say maybe 12, 13, maybe a little bit younger. So possibly they're Conan's kids. I don't know. I'm sure we'll find out on the next issue. But Conan has another running with the Crimson Witch. She still wants him because he is still the most powerful hero that she can find to bring about the return of her god. And now she's got help. And the kids do help her try to bring Conan down in the future, in King Conan. So I really love this. I love the art style. The art style is, I would say, reminiscent in some ways to Kerry Nord's. Sometimes a little more cartoony, but very similar. And the way that the coloring was done here, in the inks, I think it does flatten things out a little bit more where it looks a lot more like Kerry Nord stuff. And I loved it. I love the art. I love the story. I love the language. I love the world that Jason Aaron has created in here. I'm rating this a 5 out of 5. I think Conan the Barbarian might be the runaway hit of 2019. It's just absolutely fantastic and different from anything else that we're seeing. Again, I mean, you can compare it to books like Red Sonja, which is in the same universe, but there's just something about this particular book that has really hit a key with me, and I look forward to the next one. So Conan the Barbarian number 1, 5 out of 5. All right, let's talk about the last book of tonight, and that is Heroes in Crisis number 4. This is the second appearance of Heroes in Crisis on the top of the pile. And see there, see Chris, I do like Tom King. He can be a great writer. Written by Tom King, art by Clay Mann, colors by Timo Marie, letters by Clayton Cowles. I know there's some controversy going on about this book. I'm not talking about that here. I will be partially talking about that on Wednesday's episode when I do the rant. I do recommend you go check out the Absolute DC podcast. Ronnie and Aaron had Daryl Taylor on the show. Of course, Daryl's very close friends with Tom, so they got a little bit in depth about a couple of the craziness that people are talking about in regards to this book, and I'm only going to very briefly mention them because I think what's important here is the story. And the story is really quite good. Really quite good. The first issue, I really liked it, but I was unsure of the direction. The second issue, kind of the same. By the third, I think things started cementing, and by the fourth one, we're really exploding in the scope of this book, I think. It is brilliant, I think. It is a brilliant book. Because it does deal a lot with the heroes that we know and love. And I think I talked about this earlier when I was talking about Champions, but this is about the heroes that we know and love and how they are just people. They're people like you and I, except with abilities. Well, not all of them, right? Batman doesn't have powers, Batgirl doesn't have powers. But a lot of them are superheroes. They have abilities. Super strength, flight, invisibility, telepathy, whatever. Shape-shifting. But ultimately, they are still people with issues, right? And Sanctuary is set up as a place for these heroes to kind of overcome some of the nastiness that they have to put up with in their daily lives as heroes. And of course, that has to take a toll on people. And that's why this book is so smart, right? I think that's something that a lot of, I would say maybe most writers have never really been willing to tackle, right? I think we saw a lot of this more in the mid to late 80s when we had kind of a darker tone set into books where I guess maybe you had a lot more of like vigilantism and things like that. But things could get dark, right? Things could get dark. And we hadn't seen that in quite a long time. And now we're kind of back to that. And I think overwhelmingly the reaction to this book has been positive. Aside from some of the controversy that's going on with this book, which I don't feel is a controversy at all. But, really interesting stuff. And, you know, we get some new stuff going on in here. One of the things that I really liked is how the story of this issue is set up. And that's something that I haven't really heard anybody talk about on this particular book. So Donna Troy shows up in this issue. And she's kind of talking about herself and her namesake, right? The city of Troy. And how maybe Homer didn't get it quite right. And, you know, that we haven't found the city and this, that, and the other. I know Ronnie was a little upset about that because we have found Troy. That is a real place. I'm sure Tom knows that, so I think there might be a little more to this. Maybe he doesn't, I don't know. But, yeah, I thought about that too. I was like, huh, but we do have Troy. It is a real place. Anyway, it's irrelevant to the point of the discussion though. You know, Donna Troy is like, well, you know, was it a real place? Did Homer get it right? Did he get it wrong? Did Homer even write it, right? Was there a second writer coming in and doing the story? Or was it kind of a mix of Homer and somebody else that led to the ultimate story of the city of Troy that we know? And I'm trying to think, what was the quote? Something about confusion between two old storytellers who got mixed up. Something like that. And then that kind of cuts out of Donna Troy, right? That nine-panel grid. And then we cut to Flash and Batman outside of Sanctuary, kind of investigating, trying to get some clues as to what's happening. And, you know, one's like, oh, yeah, it's obvious Booster Gold did it. The other one's like, no, Harley Quinn did it, obviously. And then they look at each other and like, crap. Because even through all the evidence, they still can't figure out who the actual killer is in Sanctuary. And I think that was really apropos to the way that the book began, because here we have Donna Troy talking about this fabled story, extremely famous story, and we really don't know anything about it. How much is true and how much is kind of embellishment in literature, and how these two storytellers can't agree on how to tell the story. And then we have Flash and Batman, the two detectives in the team, kind of going through that, where they also can't agree on the story. And I thought that was so well done, right? Not only to bring that literary reference, but make it make sense in terms of the story of the book. I thought that was really fantastic, and it really caught me off guard. And I caught it immediately. I was like, huh, that's a really good setup to this book. But of course, it raised some questions for me, right? Because if she's questioning the truthiness of the story of the city of Troy, are we supposed to kind of maybe not accept the entire truth of what we're seeing in this comic? Maybe we haven't seen any bits of truth yet. Maybe we haven't seen the killer at all. Maybe some of these characters aren't dead. Maybe some of this stuff is not happening. Maybe some of this is a simulation within Sanctuary itself for, I don't know, let's say Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. Maybe it's a test on how they would react were something like this to happen. I mean, I'm just throwing weird theories out there, but it did have me thinking about that as Donna Troy is going through that speech at the beginning. I mean, we can maybe assume that Booster didn't do it because Wonder Woman does have him in the lasso and he says, hey, I didn't kill him. But then she also says, well, if he really believes he didn't kill him, right, maybe he blacked out, then even with the lasso, he wouldn't be able to tell the truth, right? Because that to him, that is the truth. And I thought that was kind of interesting as well. We see that a lot, I think, today in the news. You can read that however you want. I did love the fact that Booster and Blue Beetle are back together. I think their interaction was awesome. And I hope we get to see a Booster and Blue Beetle book. If Tom's going to write it, then maybe Tom's going to write it. You know, Tom's been doing a lot of Booster Gold stuff lately. Maybe he is going to be writing the Booster Gold book. But anyways, Booster Gold and Blue Beetle. Love that team. Bros before heroes. Fantastic line. I really like my favorite thing about this book, also my least favorite, was Batgirl. And this has nothing to do with the controversy. I don't like the way Clayman draws Batgirl. I know the costume's been changed. She's made older now, this, that, and the other. I'm okay with all that. I have no issues with the costume, no issues with the fact that she's back to her older self. Although I love the younger look of Barbara, but this is fine. I have no problems with that. I didn't like the proportions that were chosen. She looked very masculine, right? And to me, that's never been Barbara, but outside of that, I don't have an issue with it. I did love the interaction. Number one, the stuff that she says as she's being interviewed in her Sanctuary tapes, but also her interaction with Harley, right? Because she goes to look for Harley and try to bring her in, get some more information. And Harley just thinks, well, she's trying to get me because she thinks I kill these people. And Barbara explains that that's not the case. And then the whole speech that Barbara gives, I just loved it, right? So she talks about how, you know, I'm not here to hurt you. I'm also broken. You know, I work with somebody who thinks I'm broken, who won't give me a chance to do certain things because he thinks I'm broken. And you know the feeling because you had the same thing, right? The Joker sees you as broken. He doesn't care about you. You just serve a purpose. And that was just so sad for Barbara to feel that way, right? And especially because, number one, it was a direct tie to the Killing Joke, right? So, when Barbara's having her interview in Sanctuary, she shows her scars, right? She lifts her shirt up. You see the bullet wound in the front and the bullet wound in the back. That is the gunshot wound from Killing Joke. So, I mean, I know that there's been a back and forth about whether Killing Joke is in continuity or not over the years. This is telling us that it is in continuity. And, I mean, I always thought it was, regardless of what anybody else said. So, good. Good on you, DC, for making that decision. But, you know, that's been, how old is that book now? 30 years plus? Probably older than that. 40 years? And we're still seeing the repercussions, right? And this is, I don't think that Barbara has ever been able to process and overcome the grief of that in the way that it's shown here, right? It, in many respects, it felt more like a forced acceptance because of the change of direction of the character in her book. But here she's kind of reliving that, right? And obviously she spent her time in Sanctuary and it seems to have worked for her. And once she opens up about this whole situation and gives that to Harley, Harley realizes that, yeah, you're not a terrible person. You're not here because I'm a bad guy. You're here because you care about me and nobody else cares about me. And I thought that was so cool, right? Because for the past few years, we've seen Harley kind of been teamed up with Poison Ivy, and that's a cool relationship. I like that. But I would love to see, like, a Harley Batgirl book now. Like, it was deep and emotional. I loved it. I almost started to tear up in that one section. I thought it was really brilliantly done. And in particular, referencing the Killing Joke stuff. So I really enjoy that. There's another subplot, which I guess will become the main plot going forward. We'll see, just based on the way the book ends. But as it turns out, Lois Lane is writing a story about Sanctuary. And maybe that's kind of the tapes that we're seeing, the interviews, those nine-panel grid pages. She is writing an article for the Daily Planet and publishes that story. Wonder Woman's very pissed. Batman's very pissed. Superman's pissed, but he's like, I forgot to tell you guys. My bad. Which seemed a little weird, but I kind of understood it, right? I mean, it's his wife. And she told him the source, but he can't really reveal it because Number one, it's his wife. Number two, she's a journalist and he's a journalist. And I like that whole thing, right? Because morals and ethics aren't always, so clear cut, in particular when you have other interests to take care of. So I really like that quite a bit as well. And, if you couldn't tell, Heroes in Crisis number four is a 5 out of 5. All right. That's it. That's this episode. Thank you all for listening. It's a pleasure. It's great to be back. I hope you guys will enjoy what Dustin will be cooking up on these Comic Talk headline episodes. They are much shorter. They're 5 to 10 minutes. We did that on purpose because we want people to be in and out on the news if that's something they want to do. And if you don't care about the news, you can skip those episodes, and that's fine. But do check out his channel so you get an idea of what he's doing if you want. It is youtube.com. I don't remember the link, but his channel is generally nerdy, so check that out. And that's basically what he does on his channel. He does nerd news kind of thing, and he's going to be doing more comic-related stuff here for this show. That's going to be it. Listen to tomorrow's episode. It's going to be great, I promise. And I'll be back on Wednesday with a brand new one. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at GeekVine. You can email yell@comictalk.today. I'll catch you on the next one.